Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Pro Photography Podcast, number 209. It is March 13th, 2024.
Welcome to the New Web Pro Photography Podcast, where we talk about what's new, what's old, and what works for professional and enthusiast photographers. Find show notes, videos, and more at simfx.com/podcast.
It is good to be back, everyone. We are here to talk about all things photography today on Pro Photo Show. And I know it's been a little while since the last episode, but what I'm doing is just kind of letting us grow gradually. I actually try to let one episode at least get close to or beat the number of views of the previous, because it's a little harder to grow in podcasting than it was in the 2010s with the Pro Photography Podcast 1.0. So I'm just taking my time. We're going to be moving into having guests on the show, and I'm just trying to make each episode count and talk about things that really affect us as photographers and that are really going on in the industry, because times are changing so much with photography right now, with AI, with all these things. And we're going to talk about that a little bit today. We're going to talk about some gadgets, some news, and just see what's happening in photography as we come into spring of 2024. So let's jump right into today's show, because I've been doing some pretty interesting experiments. There's some neat stuff going on in the news and photography. I do actually want to point you in the show notes at profotoshow.com to my X-Pan crop project. This is something I've been working on for months, and I actually just published a video on it. So head over there. I'll put a link in the show notes. You can also find it on my YouTube channel, but there's more image samples if you go to the blog over on the site, but I'll link it directly in the show notes. But what I've been doing is the X-Pan, the Hasselblad and Fuji X-Pan series, 6x17 panoramic cameras are beautiful and they're iconic, but it's so expensive to buy one. They're $4,000 or $5,000. They're vulnerable to breaking because of the era they're from and the electronics they require. For the film shooter that wants to get into that kind of organic panoramic view, it's really cool. But I really enjoy shooting panoramics. So what I did is I locked myself into panoramic mode on my digital cameras. And it was a really neat experiment. It got me some really great results. And rather than just saying, hey, I'm going to crop in post, I masked off the actual screen of the camera and went out shooting for that format. And that was the key thing. I talk about all this in the video, so I won't make the podcast about that. But if you find that that might be interesting to you, go check this out. Another recent video I just published is talking about why you should stop using your white balance card, because generally speaking, you don't need it. And it's not actually getting you better edits, because there's so many variables. There's mixed lighting. There are times to use like a gray card, a white balance card, but most of the time, it's not necessary. So what I'm going to start doing on the show as well is like talk about these things along with our topics of the day and news, but because they're kind of visual things that relate to these videos, I'm going to link the video directly in the show note. And my YouTube videos, of course, are very condensed. So, you know, they're usually less than 15 minutes and they cover the topic very thoroughly. If you're not subscribed over at the YouTube channel, click through on one of these videos and go subscribe over there. I'm always watching the news in terms of what's happening with AI. And we're seeing this. I've done a few videos on the channel about this. I actually started making some AI images. And I started using things like Fucus, which is a very simple AI app that you can host locally. You're not even paying a subscription. And it's amazing. And at first, it's kind of exciting, like, oh, wow, I can make these images. And I've done some blog posts and some videos on the channel about this. And then you really start thinking about it. And it's like, the more I do it, the more I don't like it. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with using AI art, right? If you go back to the early 20th century, when photographers like Stieglitz and others were doing pictorialism. Now, pictorialism is more the approach of being very atmospheric. They used layers. They stacked negative layers. People like Henry Peach Robertson, they would do these stacks of 12 different negatives because they could get different effects with them. They would do more blurry. They would do movements. And so that was kind of the pictorialism era. and they were beautiful aesthetic images. Whereas the other side took the tone of like, this is not what photography is. Photography is mechanical. Photography is supposed to be true to life. Of course, in retrospect, if you look back on photography, nothing's ever totally true to life. It's all based on our vision, our exposure, our lens. Like, you don't see the same way I see, and your camera doesn't see the same way mine sees. The colors, all these differences, right? This is why I love going back to film, because there's kind of this standard. This is why I love editing film and why I'm always editing with my Filmist, now Filmist 2 presets. And if you're not using Filmist 2, that's kind of what keeps the show going, is my presets, my actions, my workshops. And it keeps me creative, and it keeps me making new content for you guys. Definitely check out Filmist 2 or over at simeffects.com/Filmist. You can still get a deal on it for the launch price. And when you start editing with film, you may or may not decide you want to shoot some film, but what it will do is give you this really grounded foundation for your edits. But what you realize is that even shooting with film, there's differences between batches. There's differences in how you develop. I was actually just scanning film before I started the show, and I was actually using a TT Artisan's macro lens with a film camera scanning adapter, so you can put it in the film holder and just slide it through. Maybe I'll do a video about that if anyone's interested, because it works really well if you're doing 35 millimeter film. I've, of course, used the Epson V700 series for doing wet scans of like 4x5, and I'll get lab scans done when I get my film processed as well. In every case, everyone is different. So a lot of times people think, oh, if you shoot film, it's always that look, but it's not, because there's so many variables in processing, in times. And then you convert it to digital, there's more variables entered. So even if you're doing pure chemical and printing on paper in the darkroom, it can come out different each time, depending on how you use color filters, for example, in the darkroom. You scan, it can come out different each time. I have to do a lot of different scans and tests and really kind of rack my brain when I'm creating Filmist presets. For example, today I pulled out some Portra 400 negatives, rescanned them, and was really analyzing their tones, the white balances, comparing them with other scans I've had done, like on an Aritsu, on a cool scan. Sometimes I'll take images and have them scanned three different ways. I'll have a contact print made. I'm making all as many references as I can. In my case, when I'm trying to create truly accurate film presets, I have to kind of go crazy where possible. I'm trying as much as possible to collect side-by-side comparisons of these films so that I have a digital and a film shot taken side-by-side, and now you have a true reference for that film. But what I'm getting at here is, if you go back to the early 20th century, when you had the pictorialists, they said, well, the creative aspect is good. Then there was the more mechanical, the more it has to be true to life people like Emerson, okay? Then you come to digital almost 100 years later, you have kind of the same argument, right? Is it pure out of camera, even though that doesn't truly exist, because every camera, sensor, person, lens, etc. is different? Is it okay to layer and bake in a sky, right? Now it's getting a little more extreme. You're stacking layers. Should you edit at all? Well, you're always editing, whether you're in the darkroom or in digital. The process of taking from lens to camera to print becomes an edit. So if you study like Ansel Adams, he did a ton of editing in the darkroom, a lot of burning and dodging. It was done organically and chemically, but it was still a lot of editing. Of course, with Photoshop, we can do more, which is bringing us to today. And that's kind of where I'm going with this. There's all these variables, right? We got to Photoshop and like, is this fake? Is this not? Now we come to today and we're to AI, and it's even worse. Let me continue to the news, and I'm going to come back to that topic. My topic for today is kind of along this line of, is anything real, and where do we draw those lines? I know we talk about this a lot, but I wanted to do a little more today in relationship to history, to pictorialism, to film, stuff that I'm deeply interested in and always studying. I've made documentaries about the history of photography. You can actually watch those on my channel. It's part of my Photo Perfect masterclass, but my history of photography video is actually on my YouTube channel. This was kind of news because there's all this AI stuff happening in the news, but it's also kind of our main topic for today. But what really got me thinking about this is I started doing AI. I recently saw an article on Petapixel, and Midjourney, which is another AI generation app, back to news here, can now create the same character across different AI images. Now, this might seem like nothing for a photographer, but remember, these aren't photos. So it's important not to pretend. These are being AI generated. And the problem is, as I started doing these, I started almost kind of feeling dirty. Now, I'm not saying you can't have an AI generated system that's used with legally acquired assets, but it still feels like a knockoff. We'll come back to that again in the main topic, but that's actually a significant change, is that you can generate the same character across different images versus more of a random generated from a prompt, and everyone is a different person, let's say. This is also happening in video. Video AI generation within a year is probably going to be, you can't even tell the difference. We'll come back to that as well in our main topic, so stick with me. But getting off AI for a minute, one cool news story that I saw is that Getty's new open content has nearly 100,000 images, and you can see a ton of these old, like daguerreotypes, gelatin silver, these kind of classic photographs and paintings, scans of paintings, but things that are no longer under copyright. And what they've done that's significant is they've taken all these old images and they've put them to open access with a CC0, Creative Commons Zero Licensing, which means no restrictions, and you can use it any way you want. You can make prints, you can sell prints, you can do derivative works, whatever you want, because these are long ago out of copyright. Now, I've often gone to like the Library of Congress, for example, to download scans of old wet plates and things like that that are long out of copyright. And they can be very educational and very useful. If you've been to my Shadow Hackers workshop, and the next one is actually, I think, coming up this weekend. So go to simfx.com/shadowhackers. If you've never been to Shadow Hackers, go sign up for whenever you're listening to this for the next Shadow Hackers, because it'll change your whole perspective. But if you've been to one of my Shadow Hackers workshops, you know I sometimes bring up these old images as a review, as for the lessons they can teach us in understanding digital better. And I just thought this was really cool that you can go to this Getty library and download these too. So I'm certainly going to be browsing through this and downloading some cool photographic images. And I actually do use those quite a bit in my products, because if I'm making platinum studies and things like that, like I do in emulsion actions, I'm going back and I'm sampling tones and things like that from true platinum prints. I'm actually working on a new editing pack right now that's taking samples from Stieglitz images and stuff like that, examining their color tones, the atmosphere, to accurately give us the ability to edit that way in Photoshop without jumping through a bunch of hoops while still kind of retaining our own style. That's always what we should be doing. It should always be we learn from other people and their techniques, and then we kind of apply our own style to that. The Fujifilm X100V is out. Excuse me, VI, so 6. I actually have the X100V, or the 5. It's a great camera. I bought it just before it kind of blew up and became like this TikTok trend, I guess. I didn't buy it because it was trendy. I just bought it because I finally caved and I'm like, this seems like a great street camera. And it really is. Like, early on, I was like, oh, I'd never pay that much for a camera that just had a fixed lens. But it's actually my most used camera now. What I thought was interesting is there was an article that I'll link where it talks about how much engineering it took Fuji to get IBIS, image stabilization, in-body image stabilization, in the new X100 6, which the X100 5 does not have. And it's quite a fascinating piece of technology. Now, obviously, we have IS built into the bodies of our smartphones and things like that, but we're dealing with these bigger cameras. You have larger sensors. Like, it's a lot more complicated, it seems, to get that IS in there. And this, it's really packed in on this. And so that's kind of the big feature of the new X100 6, more megapixels also, which is good if you're doing really pristine, razor sharp, like landscapes and things like that. But the 26, I think, megapixels of my X100 5, even though I am a bit of a pixel peeper, they work great. I will probably buy an X-T5 for its 40 megapixel sensor before I'll try and get an X100 6, because for me, it works fine. And the image stabilization is more relevant to me on my interchangeable lens cameras. Let me know what you think, though. I'm curious if any of you picked up the Fuji X100 6. Leave a note in the Facebook group for this show or in the show notes over in the comments of the show notes over at profotoshow.com. But this camera is going to be huge. And even if you're not a Fuji user, right? One thing takeaway, I think, this is one of the most popular cameras in the world, to the point where prices have been going through the roof the past couple of years because you couldn't get one. They're basically sold out all the time, but it never sees a case. It's always in my hand around my neck or waiting in the cup holder of my car. It's that sturdy that I don't feel like I'm going to have a problem. I have a Haug lens mount, lens hood on it to make sure the lens doesn't get scratched up. What I think is really newsworthy, though, is that the other camera companies are really missing out. They keep doing these kind of halfway, these kind of half-ass attempts at these rangefinder-style compacts. But if you think about the Fuji, it has a digital viewfinder, it has an optical viewfinder, it handles, it has dials and controls like a camera. We're seeing Nikon delve into that a little bit with some of their retro-style bodies. But these companies, this is one of the biggest markets. The compact camera is back. Ricoh, I think it's the GR3, is also very popular, but it's more of a modern digital computerized kind of camera than the Fuji's retro organic. That's why I actually love using Fuji's, is because they have dials, because they have real dials and ISO dials, and I'm not always cycling through menus, and I feel like I'm taking photos, not using a computer. So I'd like to see Canon, Nikon, and the others. Sure, they're making compact bodies, but it's not in this rangefinder category like Fuji has done with the X100V. And it's a huge, huge market. Even though I can't change lenses on it, I can put a conversion lens on it to go a little more telly. Most people just use it with that 35 millimeter equivalent lens, and it's a very good lens. This is the thing. It's not a compact point and shoot. Those have pretty much gone by the wayside because our cell phones will do that just fine. We have them all the time, and they're just as good or better than most compact point and shoots. But this is a full-size sensor, right? It's the Fuji's real sensor in this very compact body that you can have in the cup holder. Where's Canon? Where's Nikon? With these kind of cameras. Let's get on it. Where's Sony? Right? And so I think there's a lot of potential in that. Nikon has acquired the Red cinema camera company. And this is interesting because they've actually had some legal battles where I think Red was suing Nikon for the way they implemented some kind of a file format. And now Nikon has bought Red, which for photographers, most photographers have never used or maybe never even seen a Red. But among people that do both or that lean more towards the cinema photography side, the Red is a major, major brand that people are shooting feature films on. And so it's going to be interesting to see what such an iconic photographic camera brand now has all the technology and the patents and everything that goes along with Red. It kind of makes them a powerhouse. And I think it was actually a very good acquisition for Nikon. I'm curious to see what you guys think. There's probably listeners here that use both. And I think it's really going to change up Nikon's ability, particularly in video. And I think we're going to see that trickle down into how it affects photographic cameras that are primarily photographic, because really they're all kind of fusing together at this point. But we still have cameras that are more geared towards photos and others that are more geared towards cinema. Now, coming back real quick to our camera growth, computational AI. You know that when you take a photo on your cell phone, let's say you have an iPhone or a Samsung or some other flagship that takes really good photos or videos, but the camera in it isn't actually that good. And I think pretty much everyone knows this at this point. It's computational photography. It's using software algorithms and even AI to improve the photo, eliminate the noise, and fix things and make it good. And it works. And considering the tiny sensors packed into our mobiles, it's pretty amazing. But you've probably noticed a distinct difference that when you take photos on what we would call a real camera, it's completely different. See, in the early days of cell phones, there was people that did like iPhoneography and all this stuff. And it was kind of this idea that eventually cell phones are going to be as good as the real cameras. But the truth is they're evolving in very different ways, because in the cell phones, it's all about smaller, more power and more software processing, essentially doing the editing for you. Now, yes, you can take raw photos in some of these cameras, and it's pretty amazing. But that's not really what they're geared around. So I saw another article, and I'll link it, and it's talking about how Panasonic doesn't actually think people want computational photography in cameras. And this caught my eye because I was kind of hearing, you know, like, oh, well, soon we'll have these same features in cameras. And I'm like, when I use a real camera, and I'm not using that term to like pick on smartphone photos because they can be very good. And for video, I actually, for my B-roll video in particular, I use smartphone camera all the time. It's just so available. And you'll see it in my YouTube videos as well. If you're looking close, you might be able to tell the difference. But if I shoot it well, it's super, super good. I currently have an S23 Ultra. But computational photography in our big cameras is basically what Panasonic execs were saying in this interview with Petapixel is, we don't think the type of user that's buying these cameras, real cameras, wants the camera doing that much for them. And I actually completely agree with that. And I think that's going to be more and more relevant. I think we're seeing more people use film even because they want organic, real experiences. For the past year and a half or so, we've seen AI and fakery kind of take over. And I think people are getting sick of it really fast. We'll come back to that before we close out the main topic for today. But I think Panasonic's on the right course. And I think this is the real reason we're not seeing computational photography in our big cameras. Now, I think it's fine if they want to have like super auto mode. But would I use it? No, I would never use it. I want a raw file that I can edit, that I can apply a film preset, a black and white preset that I can take into Photoshop and do a platinum edit on. Right. I want my creativity in that photo and I want the data raw. And I think this is kind of what separates professionals from people just taking snapshots for fun. Now, you might say, somebody might say, oh, well, the people just taking snapshots, they're going to be better. But what is better? Is it actually better to have everything perfect? The EU has actually approved an AI, basically, security act that ultimately, I'm sure, will eventually spill over in terms of copyright and user rights and things like that. We're seeing this come up a lot where photographers are like, wait a minute, this is just copying us. This isn't making original work. And someone might argue that we're always deriving from someone else's work. But what AI models do, and what I learned the more I dug in and downloaded these AI models and for use in Focus and things like that, is that you actually download a pack that, let's say it's a gigabyte. While you might not see this on the commercial sites, when they say AI model, it's a pack of samples, basically, that it was taken from. So it's reference material that it trained the AI model from to create whatever look it's trying to do, whether it's a hyper-realistic photographic look, whether it's a anime look, right? And so these models, you can actually download a model pack, and those become the reference image that the AI is learning from. It's not actually inventing it out of thin air. So at that point, the question is, well, are these models actually legally obtained, or are they pilfered from people who actually made the photos that are being used to create the AI? And that's the big argument, which I'm sure will come up more. I just wanted to mention that quickly because we're seeing, I'm not a big fan of governments and new laws most of the time, but I think people's creativity, you do have to have some kind of limit. There has to be transparency. I think there has to be transparency in knowing whether something's a real image or not. And that actually brings us to today's topic, going back to what I mentioned when we first opened today's show. These discussions have been happening ever since the invention of the camera, when photographers essentially inherited this profession from painters. The pictorialists were saying more like, no, we inherited this from the painters and we're going to be inspired by that and make creative, artistic, blurry, dark shadows. And the more purist mechanical people were like, no, photography is a medium of its own and it's only should be used for capturing the world as it is. I don't think either one are really right or wrong. I think you should take photos the way you want. I think what's important is to be honest. And this kind of brings me to what I've really been thinking about a lot and what I've alluded to multiple times on the show, is this realism. Is anything real? Do we actually want perfection? Do we want imagery to be perfect? As lenses have gotten so sharp, I have a lot of vintage lenses, right? I'll often pull out my dirtiest old Helios. It's not dirty, literally, but the glass isn't sharp. It flares a lot because I want that aesthetic. I'll go somewhere in between and I'll pull out a Fuji lens or an Olympus lens on the OM and then take that same lens and put it on digital, right? And I'll use these vintage lenses for their aesthetic. I have a lot of really great, like, full frame and Fuji glass and Sony glass. My Canon tilt shift TSE2, I actually have the adapters to use it on my Fuji and on my Sony because I don't use a lot of Canon anymore, although I do still have my 5D Mark II as an infrared camera. But that glass is what's really valuable. And these are very expensive lenses. I have the Sony full frame primes and zooms, and these lenses are so sharp. Now, if I'm going out and I'm doing a beautiful landscape in the Huasteca Potosina, maybe I want a really sharp lens. Maybe I'm going to print a 70-inch landscape. As things have got more and more perfect, lenses are so sharp now. Cameras are so sharp. There's so many megapixels. It really does raise this question that kind of takes us back, I think, to the pictorialism of the early 19th century and this debate. Do we want everything that mechanical and perfect? And even though I can be a bit of a pixel peeper, especially when it comes to making large prints, I don't want a lens that's cruddy because I cheaped out. I don't want a lens that just has bad bokeh. I don't want a lens or a sensor that needlessly has noise. And yet I've done videos on the channel about why you should stop doing noise reduction. Because if you edit correctly, that noise is almost just like film grain. In fact, it's almost identical if you edit correctly and mix a little bit of noise reduction with natural grain in like Lightroom or Capture One. I do this all the time. If you use my either free Filmist presets, which you can get on the site over at simeffects.com, or my complete pack, you see me doing a little bit of grain. Like when I make Filmist presets, I try and match each one to the grain. Of course, you can erase that grain. You can apply a different grain. That's fine. That's the beauty of editing this way. But that grain's actually important. That grain gives you an organic feel that I think is important. You'll even notice a lot of like TikTok type filters. They add grain, usually in a fakey kind of way. But people are craving things that feel real. And this is never more true, I don't think, than today. In fact, I'm seeing this on pages. These landscape photography pages, you truly can't believe anything anymore. The photos are so perfect and so amazing, and a lot of them are straight up fake. And people call them on it, and these people will ferociously defend that it's not fake. But you never see an example of them standing there taking the photo. You never see a raw file. And you might say, well, they don't have to do that. No, they don't. But we don't have to believe them either. And I'm to the point where if I'm taking something that's really amazing, if I take a really amazing photo, I fully expect a point very soon in competitions where you have to present the raw file before you can be awarded the prize. Because the fakery, and most of people, the mainstream still doesn't even realize this, and maybe a lot of us photographers don't. A lot of these photos, and I really want you to start second guessing, a lot of these photos you're seeing in like these, you know, world-class photography or world-class landscapes, especially in landscapes, because it's a lot easier to artificially produce those than a portrait, but those are getting really good too, and you can't hardly tell the difference. I can usually kind of like, oh, that's AI, but it's getting harder and harder. So we need a system, right? And if somebody wants to make an artificially intelligence-generated landscape, it's not bad. What's bad is lying about it. If you have a group for photographs and you put these incredible AI landscapes of lighthouses and waves and stars and skies and everything, it's not fair. And you might say, well, that's how technology is progressing. The car wasn't fair to the horse either, right? But it's not the same because photography captures something real. Now, you could argue, hey, when we go into Luminar and we're switching out the sky, I don't do that on my landscapes. If I take a photo of a landscape, I might refine it. I'll use Lumist. I'll use Actions. I might apply a pictorial kind of effect, like an Orton effect or something like that. But the image is of a real place, even though if it's my vision of it, I'm not just pasting in the skies and then the sunset over here and pasting in a tree there. So that's composite photography. I think we just like with AI, I think somebody needs to be honest if they're compositing with things that weren't really in the scene. You might bracket, you might layer to get different tone values and things like that. But if you're pasting in the sky, it's not actually a photo of that landscape. There's nothing wrong with creating that kind of art. just like there's nothing wrong with painting, but painting isn't photography. And AI generation isn't photography. And it shouldn't be mixed with photography. It's the same as if it's the same, because photography has a basis in the real world. That's really the essence of photography, is the process has a basis in something real, even if we edit it to our own vision. And it's really important we're honest about that. And I think we're going to start seeing photographers and groups and things like that. I think we'll start seeing it implemented into social networks where it's demanded. It will put over the top of it, this is AI generated, with things that I've talked about on other shows like content credentials and things like that, that actually you can click on the icon in the corner. It's part of the metadata. And then it shows you the history of where that image came from. Is it all AI? Is it partly AI? Because honesty is actually important, just like in news. And this is another thing, right? With all the crazy things that we're seeing happening in the world, all the suffering over in Palestine, places like that, we're seeing pages utilizing the sensational of this. And I'm flat out seeing like war images that have no relationship to a real image. So it's not like, this isn't journalism. This isn't going over and actually capturing something that's important to history and that's important to help people understand what's happening in the world. This is someone's own vision of what's happening in the world that's completely artificial. And no, you can't tell the difference. I guarantee you, if you're on Facebook, Instagram, etc., you're seeing fake landscapes. You're seeing fake news photos. And when I say fake news, I don't just mean someone's opinion different than yours. I mean, you're seeing things that are being played off as photos that absolutely are not, and they don't tell you. I literally see photos that say things like this morning in Ukraine, and most people aren't even, it's not even clicking with them. And I look at it and I'm like, oh, that's definitely AI. But people that don't know about this technology, they're being duped by this. And the technology is getting to a point where it's so perfect. So I guess my question to us, not just as photographers, but as human beings, do we want things that perfect? Do we want to look that perfect? The filters in our phones, they filter so much that you could purify the water with it. Okay? Is that what you want? You know, you put a filter on it, smooths all your skin. And this is coming back to the fact that I keep saying, I think authentic photography is going to make a return. AI is certainly going to affect all this, but authenticity matters. So what's my summary of all this? It's that as I've gone through the years, in like 25 years now of being a photographer, I've started to go through these phases, right? Where I was, everything had to be super perfect and razor sharp, to using vintage lenses and realizing that it's not always about razor sharp. But at the same time, I still want quality because I want to be able to print large. I want my images to be authentic. I don't like faking them. If I make something that's digital art, I present it more as digital art, more as a painting or digital painting than a photograph, which I do occasionally, but my main medium is photography and video. Of course, the principles apply the same in video, but video is getting really easy to fake as well. I think what I'm getting at in the bigger picture is that we can learn from the shadows and the nuances of the pictorialist era. In fact, I've been studying more Stieglitz and more of these kind of era photos, not simply for their tones and things like how they did platinum emulsions and gold tone emulsions, like the Curtis gold tones, things like that, but also for how they used mood and atmosphere, space, line, tone, blurring. There's a lot to be learned from that. And that also the debate between pictorialism and realism photography is not so different than the debate we have about whether we edit or whether we keep it really close to pure, even though truly pure doesn't quite exist. But there is some difference between that and AI photography, because AI photography is not photography. It's a completely different medium, just like photography was different than painting. And it's going to be part of the future, but it's important, I think, that as photographers in our groups and our competitions, that we be a little insistent, that we demand a little bit, that we say, wait a minute, is this AI? No, it's not AI. Well, it looks like AI. Can I see the raw file? And people are going to get offended and they're going to accuse us of being negative and just being jealous. But you know what? It's happening a lot. And I hope that you guys will go out and leave some comments in the show notes. And I'll also, in the show notes at profotoshow.com, put a link to the Facebook thread for today's show, because do we want everything to be perfect? Do we want our faces, our lives, our photos, our images, our art? Do we want it perfect? Is that what we want? Because that's what AI is kind of trying to give us. And yet in that perfection, I think it's actually not perfect at all because there's no soul. This is what I found when I spent a week playing with these AI apps and being like amazed, like, wow, I can enter this prompt. Look at this image, you know, a model posing in a long dress. And I'm doing these things. And these images that are coming out are wow. And I've mentioned before, I think it can be useful, for example, for giving you ideas, right? Well, I'm doing a session. I'm going to a session with a barn and we're doing a white dress. And so you can enter these prompts and then kind of leave it overnight on something like Focus and say, make me 50 variants. And it'll do that. And I think it can be good for maybe giving you creative ideas. But the images felt lifeless. And I don't just mean in how they looked. I mean, I didn't feel a soul to them. I felt no gratification really after the first initial endorphin surge of kind of like, wow, this is cool that I can do this and I can make a photo of anything. We're already seeing legal cases come out, copyright, people using it to invade people's privacy and make indecent images with people's faces on them. Like there's literally already people going to jail for this stuff, being in court, being sued. Like this is a medium that just exploded onto the scene. It's not photography, but it is changing the face of society. And I think as the people whose profession or passion is one of the most important mediums of image creation and documentation in history, probably the most important, I think, well, maybe not. The writers might disagree with me, but I do think like a photographer, it's important that we draw those lines. It's important that, yes, if something looks like AI in a group, you say, this doesn't look real. Is this AI generated? And it's okay. It's okay to question. It's okay to say it because it's not okay that people are faking this. And it's us, the photographers, that are going to hold up that and say, no, this is not how it works. That's not a photo. It's fine to make an AI art group, but guess what? Those don't get near as many likes as posting an absolutely flawless, virtually impossible landscape photo in a landscape photographer's group that most people think is real, even though it's a complete fraud. How do you guys feel about it? Let me know in the comments. I don't need to go on all day because I want to hear your thoughts. And this is something that we will come back to more when we get our first Pro Photography Podcast 2.0 roundtable, because I want to hear other people's opinions on that. And I hope to do that soon. Let's go into the pick of the week. Actually, my pick of the week is going to be a small flash. You remember maybe last year that I did a video looking at the Godox Retro Flash as well as the Lightpix Lab flash that has the little built-in wireless transmitter. Really cool flash, but it's actually stopped working. Now, I need to get a hold of Lightpix. They sent me an email and said, send us a video of what's going on. They haven't completely thrown me under the bus on it, but while it was a great little flash, and I liked it for its compact, the way it looked good and kind of fit small on my X100 street camera, because I didn't want to stand out, right? The big tilty head flash really makes you kind of look like a wedding photographer. But what I also did is I picked up the Godox TT350 Mini. This is a very small hot shoe strobe tile flash with the tilting head and all the features of it, although basic, reasonably powerful. But this thing is cool because while it doesn't have that integrated built-in transmitter like the Lightpix Labs one did, I can use it with my flash controller, my wireless transmitters that I use on my other Godox lights, like my 8200, my 8600, etc. So if you already have these newer Godox style lights, it fits right into that. It's only about a $75 light. It'll be in the show notes, and I'll put my Amazon link in the show notes. If you do want to pick one up, you can use that link if you want to support the show. But I bought this. It wasn't like a demo or anything like that. Just like everything, all the gear I review on here and that I talk about, it's been really good because it actually is a little more flexible. It's a little bigger than that Lightpix. So that Lightpix is a great form factor, and that built-in transmitter is awesome. But the way this integrates also with the rest of the Godox system and my other lights, I can combine it, use as a little key light, very cheap, very powerful for its size. And the thing is, I can go out, and you've seen this, sometimes I'll do multiple lights, but sometimes I'm doing kind of a casual portrait session. I just did one last week where I was doing like these angel wings, and there'll be a video on my YouTube channel about it soon. And so we had the model with kind of these angel wings, and we went out to this dry riverbed, and I was using natural light. This is where I'll use a flash like this the most, is when I'm primarily using natural light, but I want to be able to maintain those shadows in the background and create nice keen for the background and separation, and a little bit of fill light is perfect. So I can put a light sphere on this. I can bounce it off a rock or a wall. I will literally sometimes take like a pillowcase or a blanket that's kicking around in the back of the car, throw it on a tree and take a little flash like this, or like the light picks that I can use wirelessly, and just create kind of an impromptu softbox. You will be amazed how much you can do with these kind of things. This kind of goes back to my recent video on how even a flashlight can make a great light if you use it well. You don't have to spend thousands of dollars on a light kit, because really, we're hunting shadow and we use light to find that shadow and to carve it out. Shadow is kind of like our marble, and the light is our chisel. The Godot's TT350F is a great little flash. So far, I've had it for, I want to say, about 3 months now, and it's been really good. Definitely recommend picking one up. And by the way, it's TTL. Lightpix makes a TTL version as well, but I had the manual version. Although a flash like this, I really don't use in TTL. I use these kind of strobes in manual all the time. There can be a time for TTL at a wedding or something like that, but I'm generally using these as an accent or a fill light. Sure, you could use them as the only light in the dark, but generally I'm using them to add drama to a scene, and they work amazing for that. I'll actually throw a few photos that I use this flash on the show notes to show you what I mean and how they take scenes that otherwise would have just been kind of plain daylight scenes and really jazz them up. So I'll put a few of those in the show notes. Head over to the show notes at profotoshow.com. Leave a comment, click on a link, read some of the news articles I mentioned today. I'll link to their sources as well as to the videos I've mentioned that are over there. I'll put everything. I'll put everything in the show notes for you guys. It's what we do here on the Pro Photo Show. Talk photography and how to be better at it. Check out today's pick of the week. I hope you guys enjoyed. I hope you guys will spread this, because that's actually what I need you to do to create more Pro Photography Show, is I need to see growth so I can keep growing it, invite more guests, and we can get more and more clout, right? If I'm going to invite the guests, I want to make sure they're being heard and they don't feel like they're just, you know, like, oh, just coming on to talk to me. So that's why I'm actually kind of taking this a little methodically this time around with Pro Photography Podcast as we grow and grow and grow. But I need your guys' help for that. So I appreciate you guys sharing it, leaving comments on your reviews on your favorite podcast app, etc. Thanks for being here. We will see you next time. Keep on creating and stay safe.